Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, we feature new research on chronic kidney disease, high-risk prostate cancer, peripheral artery disease, and oxygen therapy after cardiac arrest. We review the evaluation and management of syncope, follow a challenging case of immune-related inflammatory illness, and report on perspectives exploring pandemic preparedness, the Bundibugyo Ebola outbreak, and physician mental health. A new clinical decisions considers the fast track in internal medicine residency. You are the director of an internal medicine residency program who has been asked to join a panel at an upcoming national meeting of internal medicine program directors. The panel will discuss whether a fast-track option allows for sufficient training in internal medicine. Residents in the fast-track program would begin fellowship training in an internal medicine subspecialty after completion of 2 rather than 3 years of internal medicine residency. You must consider whether fast-tracking into fellowship can provide sufficient clinical training in internal medicine for trainees who pursue subspecialty practice, or whether the 3-year residency program should be maintained for all internal medicine residents. What would you decide? Read the vignettes and cast your vote at nejm.org. Finerenone in persons with chronic kidney disease without diabetes by Hido Hirspink from the University of New South Wales, Sydney, and co-authors. In previous randomized trials, finerenone, a non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist, improved kidney and cardiovascular outcomes in patients with type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease, CKD. This new study evaluated whether finerenone has similar effects in patients without diabetes who have CKD. 1,584 adults without diabetes who had CKD and albuminuria and were using a renin-angiotensin system inhibitor were randomly assigned to receive daily finerenone or placebo. Finerenone led to a slower decrease in the estimated glomerular filtration rate, EGFR, than placebo over 32 months. Robert Todo from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, Dallas, writes in an editorial that finerenone represents a potential new treatment in patients who have CKD without diabetes, but with albuminuria. The results also indicate that the addition of finerenone to a renin-angiotensin system inhibitor, with or without an SGLT2 inhibitor, may possibly provide additional kidney and cardiovascular benefits. The trial by Hirspink and co-authors is important for healthcare providers because it represents a future treatment option. The use of a mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist as an add-on therapy to evidence-based therapies in current use. Together with the results of previous trials of finerenone in patients with type 2 diabetes, the results of the trial by Hirspink and co-authors indicate that finerenone may become a foundational therapy in many persons who have CKD and albuminuria with or without diabetes. Perioperative apalutamide in high-risk localized prostate cancer by Mary Ellen Taplin from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Boston, and co-authors. Radical prostatectomy is potentially curative in patients with high-risk localized or locally advanced prostate cancer. However, relapse occurs within 5 years in up to 50% of patients. In this Phase 3 trial, 2,109 patients with newly diagnosed high-risk localized or locally advanced prostate cancer were randomly assigned to receive androgen deprivation therapy, ADT, plus the non-steroidal androgen receptor inhibitor, apalutamide, or ADT plus placebo for 6 cycles, 28 days each, both before and after radical prostatectomy with pelvic lymph node dissection. Perioperative treatment with ADT plus apalutamide was associated with better oncologic outcomes of radical prostatectomy in these patients than treatment with ADT plus placebo. Adverse events were more common in the apalutamide group than in the placebo group. Emmanuel Antonarakis from the University of Minnesota, Minneapolis, writes in an editorial that, assuming regulatory approval of apalutamide in this context, the implications of the trial by Taplin and co-authors' results are profound and disruptive. The use of ADT plus apalutamide would represent the first option for neoadjuvant and adjuvant systemic therapy for patients with high-risk prostate cancer, marking a watershed moment for the field. However, the trial leaves several questions unanswered, including why only a small proportion of patients achieve a major pathological response, whether biomarkers might identify those most likely to benefit from apalutamide, whether some patients would be better served by chemotherapy, whether postoperative therapy can be omitted in selected responders, and whether the improvement in metastasis-free survival will ultimately translate into an overall survival benefit. Nevertheless, perioperative treatment with ADT and apalutamide will most likely be rapidly adopted as a new standard of care for patients who select surgical management for high-risk localized prostate cancer. Sirolimus-coated balloon angioplasty for infrainguinal artery disease by Stefano Barco from the University Hospital, Zurich, Switzerland, and co-authors. Peripheral artery disease affects more than 113 million persons worldwide and is a major cause of impaired mobility, limb loss, and death. Evidence of therapies that reduce major adverse limb events is limited and often emerges from secondary analyses of pharmacologic interventions or selected surgical treatments. This study evaluated whether sirolimus-coated balloon angioplasty for patients with infrainguinal artery disease undergoing endovascular treatment reduces the incidence of major adverse limb events. 1,252 patients with infrainguinal artery disease were randomly assigned to undergo angioplasty with a sirolimus-coated balloon or with an uncoated balloon. Angioplasty with sirolimus-coated balloons led to a lower incidence of major adverse limb events at 1 year, which was defined as a composite of unplanned major amputation affecting the target limb or endovascular or surgical revascularization of the target lesion for critical limb ischemia, than angioplasty with uncoated balloons. In an editorial, Aaron Armstrong from the HCA Health One Swedish Medical Center, Denver, writes that the trial by Barco and co-authors differs considerably from other trials of new endovascular devices because it was a strategy-based trial that enrolled a substantial percentage of patients with critical limb ischemia, who are typically excluded from device trials. These patients, therefore, had more complex disease, and the lesions treated in the trial were longer, with a median length of 150 millimeters. Consistent with disease complexity, more than half the lesions were occlusions, and stent placement was performed as an adjunct therapy in more than 30% of the patients. These trial features contribute to the generalizability of the results because they reflect real-world practice involving patients with complex peripheral artery disease and chronic limb-threatening ischemia. These data also suggest that sirolimus-based technologies provide substantial benefit in the endovascular treatment of peripheral artery disease. Together, the results from this and other ongoing trials may provide a wealth of data on the efficacy of sirolimus and everolimus eluting technologies and substantially advance the endovascular care of patients with complex peripheral artery disease. Conservative oxygen for unresponsive patients after cardiac arrest by the Logical Investigators and the Australian and New Zealand Intensive Care Society Clinical Trials Group. Brain damage from ischemic encephalopathy is common after a cardiac arrest. Such brain injury results from both oxygen deprivation during the arrest and reperfusion injury after circulation is restored. Studies in animals suggest that high oxygen exposure after reperfusion may overwhelm antioxidant defenses, causing neuronal death. By limiting exposure to hyperoxemia, conservative oxygen therapy may attenuate reperfusion injury and improve outcomes. In this study, 1,840 unresponsive adults receiving mechanical ventilation in the intensive care unit, ICU, after cardiac arrest from 53 ICUs in Australia, New Zealand, and Ireland were randomly assigned to conservative or liberal oxygen therapy. Among these unresponsive adults, the percentage who survived with a favorable functional outcome at 180 days was not higher with conservative oxygen therapy than compared with liberal oxygen therapy. Lars Andersen and Oscar Granfeldt from Aarhus University, Denmark, write in an editorial that the current logical trial follows other neutral trials involving patients after cardiac arrest that have failed to show that specific targets regarding oxygen, carbon dioxide, blood pressure, or body temperature in the ICU improve outcomes for unresponsive patients after cardiac arrest. The logical trial thus provides important data and caution for critical care practice. Until well-conducted randomized clinical trials establish the superiority of a specific treatment strategy, it seems reasonable that supportive therapy for patients after cardiac arrest should not differ from that used for other patients in the ICU. Syncope, a clinical practice article by Roseanne Kenny from Trinity College, Dublin. Syncope, or a fainting episode, is defined as a transient loss of consciousness accompanied by an inability to maintain postural tone, resulting from temporary cerebral hypoperfusion, which is followed by rapid and spontaneous recovery. Episodes are typically brief, usually lasting less than 1 minute. Causes of syncope are classified as reflex syncope, cardiac syncope, and syncope due to orthostatic hypotension. Initial evaluation with history taking, physical examination, electrocardiography, and orthostatic blood pressure measurement identifies the cause in most patients. Risk stratification determines the appropriateness of hospitalization and further testing. Management of syncope is determined on the basis of the underlying mechanism and focuses on reducing recurrence and injury risk. In older patients, syncope may manifest as unexplained falls. Early identification of high-risk features is critical to prevent adverse cardiovascular outcomes. Consumed with inflammation, a clinical problem-solving by Hei-Lin Cho from Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. A 60-year-old woman with stage 2 triple-negative breast cancer came to the emergency department with a week of fevers, chills, malaise, nausea, and a dry cough with onset shortly after surgery and while receiving pembrolizumab as part of a clinical trial. Despite broad-spectrum antibiotics, she continued to have high fevers, developed low blood pressure, and her blood counts worsened. Imaging showed only a postoperative fluid collection without evidence of infection and mild enlargement of the spleen, while an extensive infectious evaluation remained negative. Further testing revealed strikingly elevated ferritin and inflammatory markers, along with cytopenias, splenomegaly, and hypertriglyceridemia, leading to a diagnosis of pembrolizumab-associated hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis, a rare life-threatening inflammatory syndrome. High-dose glucocorticoids were started, and her fevers resolved almost immediately. Her blood counts recovered, and inflammatory markers fell rapidly. Pembrolizumab was discontinued, and she was discharged on a tapering course of prednisone with continued clinical improvement. The inequality pandemic cycle. Rethinking preparedness. A perspective by Matthew Kavanaugh, from Georgetown University, Washington, D.C., and co-authors. The dominant model of pandemic preparedness has focused on technical capacities, stronger laboratories and surveillance, more effective vaccines and medicines, faster emergency response. Yet in real-life pandemics, some of the most prepared countries have mounted the most ineffectual responses. Among the officials and experts charged with stopping pandemics, the current understanding of what drives pandemic risk for the world is proving to be insufficient. The missing element, these authors believe, is inequality. The very wealthiest sliver of people now control several times more wealth than the less wealthy half of humanity. For example, the average per capita national income in the United States is about 15 times that in Africa. We are currently seeing a co-occurrence of increasing pandemic frequency and increasing inequality that is not coincidental. It reflects a self-reinforcing cycle. Inequality makes outbreaks more likely to become pandemics, then drives their severity and duration, while at the same time, pandemics deepen inequality, making future outbreaks harder to control and fueling the next cycle. A new inequality-informed approach to pandemic preparedness seems both warranted and practical. The social contract of Bundibugyo Ebola isolation. A perspective by Serge Tonin-Voliak from the University of Bunia, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Laurent Bélec from the Université Paris-Cité, France. The current outbreak of Bundibugyo Ebola virus highlights the consequences of a breakdown of the social contract that has been the traditional underpinning of non-biomedical public health responses to Ebola. Effective containment of an Ebola virus outbreak relies on a well-established set of interventions: early detection, patient isolation, contact tracing, source identification, and the implementation of community-wide preventive measures. In particular, the effectiveness of patient isolation is contingent on community trust. But there are no licensed vaccines or validated disease-specific therapeutics currently available for Bundibugyo Ebola virus. However, optimized supportive care has remained highly effective. Reports from multiple affected health zones have documented patients fleeing Ebola treatment centers, overt resistance to contact tracing, physical assaults on healthcare workers, and the forceful retrieval by community members of bodies for traditional burials, all of which undermine containment efforts. In such an environment, isolation is seen as a coercive mechanism that prioritizes abstract public health metrics over the welfare of individual patients, rather than a pathway to healing. The authors write that to reduce suspicion and restore the social contract, the response to the current outbreak must be demilitarized to the extent possible. Containment efforts should be embedded within grassroots initiatives. When science cannot offer a cure, trust becomes the most important countermeasure. Ebola at 50. Lessons for Outbreak Response and Preparedness. A Perspective by Alimuddin Zumla from the University College London and co-authors. 50 years after the first recognized Ebola outbreaks in Central Africa, the ongoing Bundibugyo virus disease outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Uganda serves as a stark reminder that critical gaps in epidemic preparedness remain. The current outbreak highlights enduring lessons from Ebola's history, which has been shaped as much by scientific recognition, community trust, research governance, sample ownership, and equity, as by virology and outbreak control. A more accurate account begins with partnerships among clinicians, nurses, public health workers, affected communities, national investigators, and international laboratories, and ultimately between responders and the populations they serve. The discovery of Ebola virus was a collective achievement of frontline healthcare workers, affected communities, national scientists and institutions, and international scientific collaborators. Effective Ebola control depends not only on biomedical tools, but also on trust and community partnership. The most enduring lesson from Ebola's 50-year history is that outbreak preparedness requires more than scientific innovation. It requires sustained investment in equitable partnerships, community trust, local scientific leadership, and a model of outbreak science that recognizes discovery, response, and preparedness as collective achievements built with, and not merely for, affected communities. Doctor's Dirty Little Secret: The Cost of Silence. A Perspective by Tara Khan from Veterans Affairs James A. Haley Hospital, Tampa, Florida. The vomiting may be messy, Dr. Khan thought, scanning the Tylenol in the drugstore aisle, quietly calculating its lethal dose. She heard the wail of an ambulance siren. Her shift was about to start. She returned the bottle neatly to the shelf, pulled on her white coat, and slipped back into her familiar role as an emergency physician. No one would suspect that for the past month she had been plotting her own death. But she was struggling to keep pace. The demands were relentless. 12-hour shifts often stretched into 14. And she was moving quickly from attending to a scraped knee to managing a traumatic cardiac arrest, from the run-of-the-mill runny noses to a 3-year-old's near drowning. Dr. Khan felt responsible for everyone and everything all at once, and she was deep in burnout. In the U.S., female physicians die by suicide at more than 2.27 times the rate of women in the general population, and male physicians at 1.41 times the rate of men. These statistics reflect the real suffering of physicians. But the data also challenge the enduring myth that doctors are somehow superhuman. Confronting this misconception is essential if we are to care for the physicians who care for us and ultimately resuscitate healthcare. It took metaphorically crashing into a wall for Dr. Khan to understand the delicate dance between grit and resilience. Grit is the pedal that drives us forward. Resilience is the wheel that helps us change course. Resilience guided Dr. Khan to seek help. Shame, stigma, and institutional failures may keep doctors silent, but silence is not strength. And asking for help is not a betrayal of the profession, but a reclamation of it. In our Images in Clinical Medicine, a 60-year-old man presented with a 1-month history of postprandial epigastric pain. CT of the abdomen showed a diffusely enlarged pancreas with a capsule-like rim. Serum levels of IgG4 were elevated. On the basis of the typical imaging findings and an elevated serum IgG4 level, a diagnosis of type 1 autoimmune pancreatitis, the pancreatic manifestation of IgG4-related disease, was made. In another image, a 31-year-old man was evaluated for an abnormal ECG. Echocardiography revealed marked ventricular hypertrophy. Subsequent imaging showed near-complete apposition of the ventricular walls during systole, shown in videos at nejm.org. Simultaneous pressure recordings from the left ventricular apex and aorta showed a peak-to-peak gradient of 145 millimeters mercury, which confirmed a diagnosis of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy with severe obstruction. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Send any comments or suggestions to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.